We shall kick off then. Good evening, Paddy, by the way. Yeah. Anyway, okay, so I have to, in the first instance, make full disclosure. I have yet to read this entire book. It's as simple as that. I've had a busy few weeks. I've read a great deal of it. It is absolutely riveting. It is really well written. At times, the prose is dazzling. It's made me laugh. It's made me cry. It's full of all sorts of useful analysis and very close analysis, I might say, from a highly qualified academic. Luke Kemp, for those who don't know, is a senior research affiliate for the Centre for the Study of Existential Risk at Darwin College, Cambridge University. It is an incredibly scholarly text, but at the same time, it has a very light touch. Let me give you an example of how scholarly it really is. So, one fifth almost of the book is given over to the footnotes. There we go. All of that is the footnotes. And the footnotes just continue the conversation in depth that he clearly didn't have time for in the main text. It really is a fantastic read. I have a number of quibbles with it. I think all comrades will know precisely what those are going to be. His analysis of capitalism and its global nature, and the idea and the acceptance that there is no isolated solution possible to any of the existential, potentially catastrophic risks that capitalism has created, are soluble within the confines of capitalism itself. I've come across a lot of books like this, and I'm sure you all have too. All I can do in a short talk here on a Friday evening is to give you an overview of the main thrusts or the main planks of his argument. And so here we go. It really is a roller coaster of a ride, but well worth reading. So, very early on, he takes on the notion that we have all been misled by what he calls the concept of the Hobbesian notion. I would imagine most comrades, if not all comrades, are familiar with this notion. It is the idea that without government, without rulers, without people to tell us how to behave, we would very, very quickly descend into total anarchy, and life, as Hobbes would have it, would be solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Kemp goes to great pains to discredit this notion, and he does it with reference to the history of social anthropology, the history of previous societies, with particular reference, incidentally, to the Paleolithic period. And I'm going to have an insertion of a little quote here. So on page 24, he says, "The Paleolithic was a challenging time to survive. The world went through a period of glacial cycles. During the coldest periods, global temperatures were around 5 degrees centigrade lower than today, and glaciers covered up to 30% of the Earth's surface. Africa was far drier than today and littered with around 86 active volcanoes. During this time," he says, "our ancestors wandered out of Africa into the wider world in a sociable, well-connected, egalitarian, nomadic band. This was no random choice," he says, "of societal structure. It was a winning strategy to survive the Ice Age." Now, we as socialists know that one of the things that underpins our existence as human beings is the fact that we are social beings, we are prolific communicators, and that we are capable of cooperation in a way that no other species is. And there is no way that we would have left the rainforest and got all the way across the savannah and went on to populate the entire planet without knowing that solidarity was what made us strong. And so it is wonderful to read this kind of thing, of course, coming from a non-socialist. Luke Kemp might consider himself to be a socialist, but he certainly is not a socialist in the sense that we are. Okay, so what's his argument? His argument is that all societies that get big will end up collapsing. He refers to the development of nation states as the development of Goliath. He's using the biblical metaphor, you know, David and Goliath. He says that, you know, these big states grow really, really strong, but ultimately they are really, really fragile. He talks a great deal, and this is a concept that interested me enormously, about the convergence evolution of states. And he draws parallels between some of the earliest states that developed, both, you know, in China, in the Middle East, the Near East, and in fact all over the planet as human society became more elaborate. And he says that they all follow a basic theme, which is that they get big and then they get too big and they overextend, they overreach, and then they necessarily collapse. Well, we've seen this happening, and we can see this happening in all of human history for the entire period that we've lived in a system of society based on private property. How did it all come about, he asks, when it's clear that for the most part of our development and expansion as a species, we lived in cooperative, mostly non-hierarchical hunter-gatherer nomad tribes. Well, he says, and we as socialists would agree with this, around about between 10 and 12,000 years ago, it became possible for us to settle a little bit and to develop agriculture and to create a surplus. And he argues it's when we create that surplus, but he does make a distinction on this point. He talks about a surplus that can be looted. Yep, so can be taken by another individual or another group of people and then used as a source of power. He uses the phrase resources that can be seen, first of all, and then stolen, and then thirdly, most importantly to his mind, stored. He makes a very interesting point about the development of agriculture in Papua New Guinea, and he draws a big distinction between the storing of grain, which can be stored for decades, let's be clear, and the agriculture that developed in Papua New Guinea, which was basically yams and bananas and potatoes, sweet potatoes and other kinds of potatoes, which aren't storable, at least not in the long term. Maybe 6 months is all you're going to get. Not a source of power. And he makes a very compelling point that a state, a Goliath, if you like, didn't develop in Papua New Guinea, because there was no basis for lootable, storable resources. I think it's an interesting point. He goes on to look at bigger and bigger Goliaths that grow up. He speaks a lot about the Roman Empire. He talks about the Shang Dynasty in China. And as I say, it really is very encyclopedic about the development of human societies. And also, he is always pointing out that with the rise of these states, there is necessarily a rise in inequality. That inequality, he argues, causes an imbalance and causes a weakening to the state and essentially becomes the demise of that state, the cause, if you like, of its inevitable collapse. So far, there is not a great deal that we can disagree with as socialists. We can nitpick. We can say, well, actually, this isn't quite true, and that's not, but it doesn't matter. Essentially, all the way through the book, as far as I've read it thus far, I'm punching the air. I'm going, yes, 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 we agree. Yes, you're absolutely right. And all the time, Luke Kemp is pointing the finger at global capitalism. He's saying, this is the problem. Yep, and it's all interconnected. And he actually says, I believe, I've got my notes here somewhere. Have one moment. He says toward the end of the book that there is no single solution. These problems cannot be isolated, and they need a global solution. Again, I'm still saying, yes, absolutely right. Absolutely right. So I'm going to start drawing toward a close now. Comrades will have read books very similar to this. in the past, and they will have found very little to argue about or to disagree with as they go along. But you know what's coming. You know exactly what's coming. They'll get to the end of their argument, and then they'll draw their conclusions. And that's where we're going to have a parting of ways. The final chapter, he calls it the epilogue, Slaying Goliath, begins thusly. In the biblical tale, Goliath is slain by a single slingshot-toting future king, and there's the giveaway, by the name of David. Defeating Goliath in reality is not done alone. Instead, it requires actions that leverage the people and communities around us. He comes up with some proposals for how we avert what he sees as the inevitable collapse of capitalism. First one made me laugh. Don't be a dick. How's that going to change capitalism? He says this. First, I propose a simple pledge to not be a dick. This is a pledge to not work for, invest in, or support any firm, institute, or individual that significantly contributes to global catastrophic risk. Don't work for an agent of doom, he says. Whether it is an artificial intelligence lab, a fossil fuel company, or an arms manufacturer. The idea that you are going to change an agent of doom from the inside is nonsense. Well, there's no holes in that as an argument. And the excuse of, if I don't do it, someone else will, is the sort of bullshit used by guards at concentration camps. I take issue with that as well, but that's for later. Hold yourself to a higher standard, he says. Stopping arms races, status races, and races to the bottom begins when each of us refuses to get trapped in them. Well, of course, most of us don't have a choice. As members of the working class, we are forced by economic necessity to go out and sell our labour power to the highest bidder. I made this point to Margaret, my partner, just before we sat down for our fabulous dinner of sea bass. And I said, look, you work in Barrow. How would it be if everybody in Barrow refused to work for BAE, who have their main works in Barrow? And it would be like everybody would be unemployed. More than 50% of working people in Barrow work for BAE. They do not have a choice other than to move somewhere else. Somebody's going to do it if you don't. And this is not the way to dismantle capitalism. He goes on with that argument, but to my mind, it's already lost at that point. Stage two of our changing the collapse of capitalism or resisting it or stopping it happening is to, he says, be a Democrat. He says second, so once we stop being dicks, we practice democracy. Democracy, he says, is not just a form of government. It is a culture and a way of life. One that all of us need to recapture. Be a Democrat. Don't just vote every few years, but join a union. Join an activist group. While there is no group fighting against all the sources of catastrophic risk, there hopefully will be one soon, at which point I want to say, hang on, Professor Kemp, SPGB. Join the party. Advocate, he says, for workplace democracy. Discuss political matters in a productive way, whether it be nuclear weapons or mass surveillance or climate collapse, with friends and family members. Clearly hasn't met my friends and family members. Stage three of the resistance, he says, is vote against the apocalypse, and goes on to suggest that if you vote for the party that's promising to lower your taxes and not for the party that's promising to reform the abattoir in the interests of the animals slaughtered therein, you're doing a good thing. And the fourth stage of the resistance, he says, is don't be dominated. We all know, as revolutionary socialists, that the only way to abolish domination is to abolish capitalism. I'm going to leave it there. I've still got a load more notes. Hopefully we can have a good discussion about it now.